Hi, listening friends. Before today's episode, I wanted to play a short clip of a dear friend of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture and one of your fellow listeners to the podcast, psychologist Pamela King. We're in the middle of a $25,000 matching campaign. And as we get closer to the end of 2022, every little gift helps us double the impact. Please consider supporting this work by giving online at faith.yale.edu/give. Linked in the show notes.
I'm Pam King, and I'm the executive director of the Thrive Center at Fuller Theological Seminary and the Peter L. Benson Chair of Applied Developmental Science in the School of Psychology at Fuller, and an avid follower and supporter of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. At this moment in history, where it feels like the human species is needing a new vision and way to go forward on a planet, in social structures, and civil societies that are crumbling, we need a vision of hope that infuses us with peace, strength, courage, and joy to participate in God's ongoing work in this world. That is not just of redemption and bringing it back to the way things perhaps were, but to bring things forward to completion to what God intends. And Miroslav's work speaks poignantly to that. He gives us a vision for how to participate in God's work. He informs my psychology of thriving. His theology undergirds what humans should be and can be. And I hope that science can illuminate that. I'm a huge fan of the podcast For the Life of the World. I look forward to doses of not just insight and visionary thought. I look forward to thinking about justice, civic life, becoming the person that I think God wants me to become. I look forward to diverse perspectives, rigorous theology that's really rooted in life's experiences and not just gives us a vision to be better Christians, but informs us how to be better humans for God's sake.
Check out Pam's work online at thethrivecenter.org. And thank you for helping us make the kind of impact Pam just described by supporting our work financially. Give today toward our $25,000 matching campaign at faith.yale.edu/give. And now on to the show. For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Visit us online at faith.yale.edu. This episode was made possible in part by the generous support of the Tyndale House Foundation. For more information, visit tyndale.foundation.
When you're in the empire business for over a millennium, you learn that this cannot last forever. Ultimately, your borders are going to be breached. And either you become bitter and enraged, or you learn suffering love. And these icons were communicating suffering love. And so I saw something that was not in the American conversation in the wake of 9/11 in these images. And I was hypnotized by them. I was drawn into the study of Byzantine art because of the power of these images. And then in the art museum where I was studying, there was this haunting image of Mary that was the most poignant of all of them because it in one eye gulp, it communicated the lessons that I just suggested of suffering love. This one has two angels bearing not scepters of triumph, but the instruments of the passion. As the Byzantine Empire was losing turf, they were driven back to that original reality that Christ himself and his mother were refugees that were on the wrong end of Roman political power. I was staggered to realize that this icon, the first surviving instance of it in the history of art, was born as a protest to the violence of the Crusades.
This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. One of the most prolific and symbolic icons in Christian art is an image of Mary holding Jesus, flanked by two angels. Mary's eyes are soft and sorrowful, a pastoral, empathic gaze that both sees you and your suffering, and yet sees the grand horizon of your potential beyond the pain. The Christ child in her lap looks not at you, but at an angel bearing the instruments of the crucifixion. but the fear in the child's eyes is balanced by the intertwined hands of the mother and son, which neither cling nor worry. His sandal is loosed, revealing the soft sole of his foot, his heel, which would be bruised in the stomping of the serpent. The icon, painted just about a millennium ago, is truly international, one of the first viral images, a meme, if you will, meant to offer succor and solidarity, invoking not swords and Christian power, but compassion and help, suffering love. Today on the show, art historian, critic, and associate professor of art history at Wheaton College, Matthew Milliner, reflects on one of the most powerful and moving of Christian icons, the Virgin of the Passion, also known as Our Lady of Perpetual Help, which he develops in his latest book, Mother of the Lamb, The Story of a Global Icon. First produced as a response to failed Christian empire and the violence of the Crusades, then mass-produced and proliferated as a norm of Christian aesthetic worship, the icon offers a unique filter for contemporary understanding of faith and power, the Christian temptation to nationalism and empire, the meaning and visual expression of suffering love, and the beauty of an engaged solidarity and a prophetic witness. Matt and I start with about 30 minutes of historical and theological context for the icon. The fact that the icon was created at the far side of a failed attempt at Christian empire, in a context of crusader violence. Matt's personal experience of finding and receiving the ministry of this icon in the years following 9/11-2001, during a period of both national uncertainty and fear, as well as personal suffering of a late miscarriage. The second half of our conversation is a deep dive into the visual elements of the icon. And while it isn't totally necessary, it would probably be best served by visually inspecting the image yourself. And we've posted a link to the image in the show notes for that very purpose. Perhaps a very brief encouragement from Matt is in order right off the bat.
All of these resonances of meaning are welcomed. And part of the fun of medieval art is to bring in your own interpretation. The canon is not closed in interpretations of these great historical Christian images.
Yeah,
they're waiting for you to come along and provide your own valences of meaning within the matrix of Christian theology, right? Not just out of nowhere, but from your own suffering and experience, and then within the contours of Trinitarian wisdom. All of that is welcome.
Thanks for listening today, friends, and may you find perpetual help in this waiting season of Advent. Matthew Milliner. Matt, thank you for being back on the show.
Thanks for having me back, Evan.
I think talking to you about Christmassy things, or things that I associate with Christmas, like the Virgin Mary, is one of my favorite things to do. So you now are associated with Christmas with me.
I'll take that any day.
For some reason, likely, you know, having to do with the way Christmas was sold to 20th century America, the Virgin Mary and Christmas just get tied together because of the virgin birth. And
yeah, she's brought out of storage.
Brought out of storage. And I think, like, we've talked about the role of Mary in Christian practice and the Christian way before. And I wanted to start just with a little non-Marian context and have you explain the role of iconography in Christian practice. What is an icon, and why do Christians historically allow these icons to dwell with them? I know, because you've been public about it, and it's in your book, that you have icons throughout your home, that an icon of the Virgin Mary is all over the place. Why do people live with icons?
It's the manner in which God chose to reveal himself. He didn't send a message that you could throw in the wastebasket after you've done receiving the cognitive content. He instead chose to take on personhood and permanently take on personhood. And therefore, the vehicle wasn't a pen gliding across a page, but was a embryo gestating in a womb. And consequently, the means of communicating how that communication took place must entail images in addition to text, not in replacement of text, not in competition with text. But the ancient Christian said, if a pagan wants you to show them their faith, point to an icon, right? Show them, like, this is how God came into the world. And so that, for me, it's so intuitively natural, of course, that the Christian church would articulate that. And you might say, well, what about the aniconic strains in ancient Christianity? That is, what about the aspects of the early Christian witness that were against images? Well, of course, at the same time, that is the other corollary to the mystery. In a context in which you have an image-saturated pagan world, it's not just images that will do. In fact, you have to show how these images are different and distinct, not a philandering Zeus raping mortal women. I mean, wouldn't that be a disaster if that was our universal Christian view of God? Oh, gosh, they had to distinguish themselves from that.
Right. Yeah.
Instead, it's this mysterious annunciation. That is how. And so slowly after that distinguishing from an image saturated world takes place, then once that break had occurred, here is the appropriate way that images can be used to communicate how God came into the world.
So let's speak about iconography of Mary in particular. Can you give us a brief contextual history? Images and icons of the Virgin Mary, are they present from the very beginning? What historically has the role of Marian iconography been?
Absolutely from the get-go. Because this is communicating that he is not an Gnostic apparition, a film projection from heaven, but came into the world the way all of us do. And the earliest one is on your campus. Michael Pepperd made the case that the earliest image of the Virgin Mary is an annunciation that happened at a well from Dur Europos on the Euphrates River that survived and was brought to the Yale Art Gallery, where it is to this day. So this is third century. Of course, in the catacombs, you have images of Mary as well. So again, it's not positing her as this alternate goddess, but in some senses, playing off the fact, instead of God being a mother, God having a mother, an even more daring conception, pun intended.
Right.
You would be reticent to depict the Father, because then you would be playing into the hand of the hyper-visualized pagan world. But to depict the mother and the invisible Father gestating and then manifestation of the Son, this happened immediately in Christian history. There was then, over the centuries, some reticence about it, as there should be, right? Because again, are we overcoming the wisdom of the Old Testament of the Hebrew Bible? And then there was the great culmination of that at the Seventh Ecumenical Council, the year 787, where it was chosen that theological resources were brought to undergird this early Christian decision to visualize God. And so because of that final vindication of icons that the entire church agreed upon, East and West, it is just not problematic.
Okay, so that's really helpful. But I want to give you the opportunity to introduce the Virgin of the Passion, which is also known as Our Lady of Perpetual Help. Listeners, if you would, I would suggest, in fact, that you pull up this image, and we'll make sure that this image is available in the show notes for this episode. Give us an introduction to this icon, Matt.
So it was the days after 9/11, where, if this might be in living memory for some people listening or not, but one must remember the complete uncertainty. We just edit that out, but one didn't know if this was the beginning of World War III, if this was just the first of about 50 different hits that were about to come along.
Right.
And so the entire country is rattled in this regard. And then there was the ensuing Iraq war that came afterwards under the pretense of stopping what could be future attacks. And there was a disturbance in the country that happened nationwide. And of course, an international concern as an aggravated American response was taking place, national protests. Everyone is just...
Yeah, I remember those days. I was an undergrad. I was a freshman in college.
Yeah.
It was hard to start adulthood that way.
Yeah, I remember people in our congregation, you know, is my son going to be now drafted, right? Is this what's going to occur? And not an unjustifiable concern. The churches filled out for a time and then that waned. I remember morning and evening prayer services we hosted. I was serving as a youth minister at the time. We were just overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And so in the midst of this, I was a seminary student and I find myself wandering into the Metropolitan Museum of Art for an exhibition entitled Faith and Power. You'd think, you know, with the ostensible title Faith and Power, it's talking about a fusion of empire and the iconographic, right? That's what the Byzantine world, the Eastern Christian Empire that lasts around 330 to 1453. And in some senses, that's what the title was baiting people into that understanding. Look how icons are used to buttress empire, literally empire in this case. Mm-hmm. And what I found was exactly the opposite in this exhibition, because it was the twilight of the Byzantine world that was represented in this exhibition at the Met. And in this darkened room with almost a candle-lit ethos the curators attempted to evoke that, you had instead suffering and pathos. You had not aggressive imagery, but imagery that was mourning from within. And it's not showing you what it's like to build an empire, but what it's like for an empire to wane. And as I walked through and looked at these eyes, the eyes of these icons looking back at me, I sensed this is what you learn when you're in the empire business for over a millennium. You learn that this cannot last forever. Ultimately, your borders are going to be breached. And either you become bitter and enraged, or you learn suffering love. And these icons were communicating suffering love. And so I saw something that was not in the American conversation in the wake of 9/11 in these images. And I was hypnotized by them. I was drawn into the study of Byzantine art because of the power of these images. And then in the art museum where I was studying, there was this haunting image of Mary that was the most poignant of all of them, because it in one eye gulp, it communicated the lessons that I just suggested of suffering love. And the way that it did that was it wasn't just a virgin and child, but it was a virgin and child with two angels above them. And you might say, well, that's kind of normal, but not this one. This one has two angels bearing not scepters of triumph, but the instruments of the passion, which is rare. It ironically didn't occur as much as possible, right? There was a sort of attempt to forget that horrible episode that is at the culmination of all four Gospels. But they were driven back as the Byzantine Empire was losing turf. They were driven back to that original reality that Christ himself and his mother were refugees, that they were on the wrong end of Roman political power. And all of a sudden, a Christian empire finds themselves in that situation again. And so I was taken aback by this. And then I learned the astonishing historical truth about this icon that you couldn't make it up. It couldn't be any more appropriate. Yeah. I was staggered to realize that this icon, the first surviving instance of it in the history of art, was born as a protest to the violence of the Crusades.
Yeah. So icons as a protest is just really interesting. And I think when, especially if we remember your first point about the use of iconography in the kind of reality of the incarnation, is the incarnation a form of protest?
Well, in some senses, the incarnation, it's a protest of evil and of death and of suffering. But in the other sense, it's the ultimate form of investment, right? It's a total solidarity with the physical, earthly, human condition. And so it's both and protest of anything that would hinder that life from coming into its fullness, that is evil itself. But on the other side, it's not this cheap, thin protest like, oh, I don't want to get involved, so I'm going to protest. Yeah. It's, no, I want to get involved. And so I'm going to protest anything that would hinder this from coming into its fullness.
I mean, I think that it's worth a short tangent to like kind of comment on that element. So, because insofar as art has a political dimension, and insofar as these icons were, you know, have an unavoidable political dimension, insofar as the church has an unavoidable political dimension. Let's think about what true Sure. protest might even be. And I hadn't thought about it in just these exact terms until you spoke them. But what is a protest without investment? What even Right. would that be? It would be
it's cheap,
nothing
it's
more
thin.
It's cheap, thin, Right. but also a kind of degradation. It's a kind of
Right.
it's a kind of distancing from culture. That is, would be the absolute opposite of love. It's a kind of it's detachment. It's cultural detachment. It's removing oneself in
Right.
an important way.
Yes, you quickly learn that if you have people in an institution, say, that you're a part of who just want to protest the institution without a continued investment in its survival, they're not very helpful, are they? Right? It's almost more for Yeah. them. But then there are people on the edge of the inside that are saying, okay, here are the things that need to change, but I want this thing to still be around. Mm. And that's
Yeah.
the form in which God enters into this whole project of existence, right? He's on the edge of the inside. He wants it to stay, but he's resisting the manner in which this creation that he brought into being is being Mm. wrenched away from his original intention.
Yeah. Give us the personal aspect of this story.
Sure,
I'm thinking
sure.
of the way you describe and open the book.
I mean, I could keep it on the one side of the national level, and I know you want more than that, but I'll just follow it through lest I forget Please. This. What really took me back was that I remember taking my students to the Ground Zero, seeing the makeshift memorials that occurred. Some of them gruesome, some of them beautiful, right. some of them just lamentations, some of them expressly Christian. And over the last 20 years, seeing that site develop and going to discover the myelin-inspired depressions, which we know as reflecting absence, being the 9/11 memorial, which is not only eloquent, or just as the Vietnam Memorial is sort of a gash on the national fabric, in the same way this is an indentation, like fang marks of a departing cobra, I sometimes describe it, on Ground Zero to lament yeah. that act of violence. And what just happened this year was that the St. Nicholas Church was completed. And the St. Nicholas Church was a reconstruction of the little tiny Orthodox church that was destroyed when the South Tower collapsed. And Santiago Calatrava, who also did the World Trade Center Transportation Hub, which sort of looks like this massive angel nearby. And then he reconstructed the church, and he deliberately evoked a mosaic from Hagia Sophia that looks like the Virgin Mary. And so if you go to the St. Nicholas Church, it just happened this July, it was consecrated. He wants it to look like Mary. And when it's an abstract stylized image of the Virgin. And so what truly took me back as I was just completing this publication is that, oh my goodness, the 9/11 site now is itself a version of the Passion. I'll explain. You have this exterior church that resembles the Virgin Mary. You have this angel-like train station. And then, of course, you have the famous cross that is memorialized, the cross from the beams of steel that emerged in the chaos of 9/11 that became a flashpoint of hope inside the museum itself. You put all those ingredients together along with these two depressive marks suggested by the two angels with mourning, is that it almost like the site itself is saying, okay, America, time to learn the lessons that the Byzantine Empire long before you learned. I don't say that to a facile conflation of Roman or Byzantine imperial aggression with American empire. Right? I know that history is complicated. I know that those distinctions need to be made. But what can be conflated is the need for deepening humility and wisdom in every imperial project that ever came about, whether it's a contemporary nation state or an empire of old. So all that to say, that would be one angle which moved me to sense that the wisdom that the Byzantine Empire learns, instead of just developing new techniques of warfare, they develop new interior forms of prayer practices that are deepening the mystical silence of the Christian seeking God. So there's that one external side that I can mention. But on the personal side, the only reason that I was even attentive to any of these new currents of deepening, maturing devotion at all was because we went through some suffering in our own life. Just as a time when everyone in my circle of friends and family were having children, we thought, my wife and I, that we were going to be the first out of the gate, in the sense that, you know, we had announced that my wife was pregnant. We were really excited about this. And then we had a very late miscarriage, and we didn't quite know how to field this. It just kind of came out of nowhere. And all of a sudden, these icons that I was studying of this virgin and child almost seemed a mockery of kind of what we're actually going through. And then I encountered this icon, which showed the suffering of Mary, who's going to have to watch her son die. And so I just found this, when you need new dimensions of the Christian faith to unfurl before you based upon your own suffering, the Christian faith is capable of delivering if you actually bother to look. And there it was. I saw suffering icons that spoke to the comparatively minor suffering that my wife and I were going through. And so that just sort of began this journey. And I found that this icon, known as the Virgin of the Passion, and again, Our Lady of Perpetual Help in the West, it has two titles because it has embraced both the Eastern and Western flanks of the Christian church, is that one of the reasons that it's so invincibly pervasive is because people continue to suffer. And insofar as they suffer, this icon has this mysterious ability to speak to them. And that's why it won't ever go away. I got to the point where I had my eyes open for it. And I initially for the first 5 years was sort of surprised to keep seeing it everywhere. And then that surprise just sort of disappeared because it morphed into expectation. I would be in some part of the world and be like, okay, where am I going to find Our Lady of Perpetual Help? And lo and behold, whether in Wall Drug in South Dakota amidst the Native American populations there, or in Curitiba or somewhere in India, I mean, there she was. There always seems to be one shrine dedicated to her. There are 14 churches in Chicago alone with either dedicated entirely to this image or with major shrines that put her at the center. And again, it just, because this faith of ours has this ability to speak to those who are undergoing suffering. And so you might not need this icon right now, but there might be a time in your life where you find that this is the only icon that can minister to you.
Let's talk about some of the components of it. Because as you speak about the kind of personal that seems to have been like witnessed almost by the icon, that it represents this witness to human pain and suffering, which is individualized. And I think it goes without saying, you know, that human suffering is sort of incommensurable in a way. You know, it feels shallow to try to compare them. Like there's real pain at any stage of a miscarriage, of losing any child. And of course, the incommensurability of that human dignity is what grounds the incommensurability of human suffering. And yet there's this kind of universal witness to each of the individual expressions of pain that the icon represents. I'm wondering if you can give us a little more on approaching Christian devotion through this icon, through that lens of passion, as opposed to through the lens of power.
Well, and that's the thing. So when I'm in grad school, it's sort of the tail end of the fashion for deconstruction, and power is the lens through which everything is seen. In a field like Byzantine art, it's, of course, always wants to be the trendy field that everyone's looking to, but we're so relatively conservative and ancient as a discipline is concerned.
Sure.
And therefore, we're trying to catch up. And so there were people like, you know, take the exhibition title, Faith and Power. Oh, if we just explain Byzantine art in terms of power, then people will pay attention to us. And so that was attempted. And I remember, and a lot of that work is important because imperial power was a major dynamic in this world. I don't want to discount the importance of that. But I remember reading about this icon, the Virgin of the Passion, the first historical instance of it. And someone actually saying, well, clearly this was a tool for military recruitment because Mary is holding her son and her son's about to die. And of course, we know, wink, wink, what's really going on here is you should give your son to the Byzantine army. And it's like an Uncle Sam poster. And I remember reading this and be like, what? There's no Byzantine army left when this icon was painted. And I'll explain. So when it's on the island of Cyprus in the year is 1192. In the year 1191, it's the Third Crusade, the King's Crusade. They're sending the rabble. They figure if we send kings, then it'll all work out. So let's send Richard the Lionheart from England, Philip Augustus from France. They'll go. They'll liberate Jerusalem. So Richard the Lionheart ends up in Cyprus, turns it around quickly, conquers it, sells it to the Knights Templar, moves on to try to conquer Jerusalem, does not succeed. But the Knights Templar are subjugating this Orthodox population, forcing them to cut their beards, disemploying any of the government officials. And in this context, this icon is painted. In particular, right after the Knights Templar slaughter the Orthodox population on Easter morning in 1192.
Wow.
So there's just no government anymore. And so with all of the conversation going on about Christian nationalism, right, you just lose hope of ever getting into that conversation because there are certain teams, you know, there's this team and this team and like, well, no one wants to hear what Orthodox iconography has to say about it because they assume it's irrelevant. But I want to be like, what could be more relevant than this image? It is the first arguable post-Christendom icon, right? It is born on the far side of a Christian imperial project that is demonstrable. And in fact, it shows that when the Christian faith is liberated from those entanglements, it can actually fully come into its own. Now, again, I'm fully aware that Christian nationalism is a complicated thing, and there are multiple factors. You can have about 15 different nuanced positions, but at the end of the day, this icon is illustrative of a liberated Christianity. And so to suggest that this icon, with the instruments of the Passion delicately hovering over a virgin and child, is military recruitment, there's no military. It's like they're not saying, all right, let's fight back. It's they're at peace with the fact that you cannot win against these overwhelming odds. And it's not to say that fighting and resistance doesn't have its place. One of the ironies of this icon is that two scholars have actually made the case, really competent professionals, who have said that this icon is actually connected to the only successful slave revolt in human history. That is, of course, in Haiti. That this happened, and she's the patroness of Haiti. So I'm not saying that there isn't time for appropriate resistance, but I am saying, and this icon can be connected to that as well, but this icon really does, in some senses, impart to us lessons that are urgent for us today. The icon painter whose name we know, who painted the first version of it, his name is Theodore Apsevdis. He retreats into the mountains of Cyprus where the crusaders aren't going to chase after him. He is marshaled by a ex-governor, that is an Orthodox person who no longer has a job, to repaint a church. And in order to repaint that church, he has to draw upon those resources of suffering, love, and responses to violence. Instead of just sharpening his blade, he dips his paintbrush and mourns and laments.
Say more about that alternative, right? The temptation to pick up a blade, but instead to take up the brush. And especially for this current moment, because even if it's just a metaphorical blade, I think we see a lot of our communicative efforts right now, even the ones that are artful, even the ones that are ingenious at a level of appealing to human aesthetic and appealing to the deep psychology that underlies that aesthetic, that we are still in a moment where the brush is not a forgiving, suffering love brush. You worry about the mode we're in right now, where we're just looking for a winner. We're still looking for someone to decree victory.
left and right, left and right, right? Both sides succumb to that completely. Like, and if I am in power, I want vengeance on those who kept me out for so long.
Sure.
And there's so many different avenues I could take here, but instead of taking kind of the interstate, right, where everyone seems to be clogged right now, I want to take some of the blue highways, the unexpected routes, just to get a different angle on this.
Yeah.
And one example I would say is that let's take, and I'm not trying to pick on trad Catholics, but let's just take, for example, a pope that is lionized by many traditional Roman Catholics today, Pius IX. Pius IX is the reason that this image has spread all over the world. He commanded the Redemptorist Order of Priests to spread it everywhere. And they obediently did so, which is why everywhere from Chicago to Cairo to Curitiba, there it is. Mm-hmm. It is Boston, Brooklyn, and Beirut, and Bangkok. I mean, really, all of those cities have major shrines to this image. I don't think Pius IX realized just how appropriate of an icon this was for him to choose, because as he's losing the Papal States against his will, he has to come to terms with a reduced, more spiritual, less politically empowered papacy. That papacy that we're all familiar with today.
Sure.
And it hasn't quite retreated to the contours of Vatican City just yet, but it's on the way. And none of this is gets his blessing. He's dragged into it, kicking and screaming. And he chose an icon, ironically enough, that testified to precisely the same conditions under Orthodoxy. None of them want to give up Cyprus, that was a completely Byzantine island that is tethered to the Eastern Orthodox imperial power. They weren't happily surrendering it to Richard the Lionheart so that it would become a crusader state for the next 400 years. It's against their will, but they nevertheless find themselves in those conditions. And this icon testifies to the kind of wisdom that's going to be necessary when Christians no longer have the power that they once took for granted.
Right. Or that might even defy the originating intent of distributing it, if I'm reading you correctly.
Okay, right. He didn't know any of this because all of that is buried information. He's unconsciously drawn to the icon. And now that we know the history of it, we can say, Pius IX, maybe the Holy Spirit was leading you. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's something unconscious going on desire to be corrected.
Totally.
Maybe.
I had to come to the point at the end of the book after making this case for Christianity on the far end of power. I had to say, look, there are some people that are called to legitimate defense or protective warfare. I get it. These are complicated historical scenarios. I mean, should I say that all Christians should relinquish any political debate whatsoever? Not at all. But even when we do our absolute best, we are going to inevitably sometimes find ourselves, as the Orthodox Christians of Cyprus did, in a place we don't want to be. And when that happens, sometimes it's like the capsule of Christian political wisdom can finally release its enzymes only under those conditions. And what a privilege to be a part of that side of things.
Yeah.
And that's what this icon represents.
Yeah. The kind of solidarity that it represents.
Yes. Humility and suffering love. Right.
Suffering and love.
Exactly. Which is why the African American church has taken such a profound interest in this icon. You might say, really? Of course. Go to Holy Family Church in downtown Chicago, and you will see a largely African American congregation that is centered around this icon. That icon is the reason, according to tradition, that church survives. And it's now primarily a Black church, and it's a wonderfully integrated congregation. And they have not found any need to remove that icon from its place of prominence. At the Rock Church in St. Louis, major church in that city that has been so rocked by contemporary events, there is a major African-American church with Our Lady of Perpetual Help, this icon, at its center. Mm-hmm. And they see that icon as the focal point of Black Catholic devotion. And you can't make this stuff up. It's everywhere, to say nothing of the whole Native American connection that I pursue in an entirely different book. But it's just, For me, it's so clear. If you're losing terrain and turf, this icon, or if you're losing resources or health or anything, this icon is there to minister to you. It's one of the tools that the Holy Spirit uses.
I want to talk about the components of the icon and take some time here to try to understand and do some interpretive work. And clearly, it's the work of a book. It's the work of, you know, a lot of study. And so I'd like to talk about some of the individual components that really guide us to this kind of pathos, as you describe. And with that, I want to point out the fact that for you, this icon represents a kind of ocean of meaning.
Mm.
That its horizon extends much further than the, I loved this as well, a kind of gulp that you,
yeah.
a visual gulp that the icon does present, yes, but then but its horizon goes much further. And if I may, I want to start with the eyes, because Mary's eyes to me sort of look just beyond me. Yes, she's looking at me, and you have very clearly made the case that the location, the centrality of the icon as it's presented in churches, as you've just even been describing in St. Louis and Chicago, it does put you in the place of Simeon. You were referring to, I think, Luke there, where we are standing in Simeon's place to be receiving and beholding and invited to engage the Christ at an individual level. So I hear that. And yet her eyes, they just look slightly like they're looking above me, like there's a longer horizon than just me. So she engages me, yes, but her eyes are lifted and they're sorrowful eyes.
Yeah.
And of course, the eyes of icons in general are gripping, and we see into them. We feel seen by them. What do you make of Mary's eyes in the Virgin of the Passion?
Yeah, so in the Cretan version of them, so when this icon is revived in Crete, when the Byzantine Empire finally collapses for good in 1453, that's when the eyes really come into their own. So the 1192 version is she's sort of looking at the spear that the angel is hovering, worrying about her son, perhaps contemplating Simeon's word, "A sword will pierce your heart too," who's painted just across the nave. And then when it becomes a portable icon in Crete, that's when they really, those eyes reach a level of perfection and development in the history of art that is arguably unsurpassable. And that's when the icon is no longer looking at something, but instead, as you so well said, is looking at you. And I love how you described it, because with these eyes are tutorials in pastoral compassion. So when you look at someone who's suffering and the eye lock face to face, I mean, you both have to look to them and engage their suffering completely. Which she does, undeniably, as she looks at you with those eyes. But I love how you put it. It's just she also looks beyond you, maybe to see, although this cannot be expressed because it would be too soon to make these connections when the suffering is fresh, but she might see what God is going to do with you as a result of this suffering. And she knows the suffering that's ahead of you. She can see all seven stages of grief, or however many more there are on top of that. She's prepared to walk with you in this journey. Now, when I say this, someone might, where are you saying the Virgin Mary is an independent entity that kind of is going to kind of be a co-redemptrix apart from Christ? Not at all. What I'm simply suggesting is that Mary is an encapsulation of the church functioning at its pastoral best. That is a scriptural understanding. In Revelation 12, she's the woman clothed with the sun. She is the ecclesia, the gathered ones. One of the most liberating things is for Christians to realize, don't get caught up in Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox debates about Mary's sinlessness and all these details. That's irrelevant to what we're discussing here. You can discuss that, but what we're talking about is Mary as a symbol of the church. And if someone looks at you in that way, it's almost the church, the maternal compassion of the church, right? Didn't John Calvin himself say, you can't have God for your father without the church for your mother? Well, that's who she is. And so let her function and communicate at that valence. And then she looks at you with that level of compassion. And you have to imagine that when that icon goes viral, insofar as that's possible in the 15th century, and painting after painting is made, communicating the eyes and that compassion with those unique, unsurpassable lines that don't signify aging as much as they signify wisdom and compassion that surround the Virgin, that those eyes are they're going to carry that suffering with you. I don't know if you've ever been looked at with those eyes, but you know when it happens to you, and you sense, thank you for not opening your mouth with some dumb theory like Job's friends as to what God is up to in the suffering of my life. I just need to be looked at with those eyes. And that those, and so she models, she is better than a class in pastoral theology. If you were just take, and plus you look at the vitriol that we are dragged into, the muck pits of internet debate. And if you would just pause from whatever you're about to weigh in on and look at those eyes instead, you would find what is missing from our political discourse immediately deposited into your psyche.
I mean, this, I think you cover this in your chapter, Mary as Priest. And that's just another one of those scandalous things that's going to just rack patriarchal Christianity. And yet it seems undeniable in the sense that the pastoral nature of her eyes, it really does connect. And who has looked at me like that? And I can tell you, I'm sorry to say it hasn't been a priest.
But it'd be nice if a priest would look at you in that way.
Yeah. It would be nice. Yeah. The spiritual presence here that Mary is offering in bearing witness to the Christian who is enduring, maybe after the collapse of their world.
Yes, exactly.
Is that comfort that it's the gospel presented to us. It's a human acknowledgement of pain and a carrying of Christ, a carrying of Christ's passion into that domain and all bearing witness. And I want to ask about the eyes of the baby Jesus.
Yeah.
Which look in a different direction.
Totally. He engages the instruments of the passion because he is afraid. And this, it takes so long for the church to acknowledge the full humanity of Jesus. The church is so constantly pressing the brakes on that, even though their formal theology requires them to address his full humanity. They don't want to visualize it. It takes a long time for the crucifixion to be depicted in a realistic fashion, right? With him actually dying. And now you're able to acknowledge the fear of this little child. It's completely within the bounds of Christian orthodoxy, and yet it's rare that this move is made with this level of explicitness. And sometimes the versions of this icon will have it spelled out in Greek in the bottom. Look, he's afraid. He's really afraid. And I know you are. Yeah. Oh, they'll say it. That's what sometimes the Latin and the Greek will say, is that the one who previously, that is the angel who previously tidings of joy brought, right, the Annunciation, now brings the tidings of tragedy, right? This is what's going to happen. And so all of a sudden, really, it's Jesus's pastoral connection to you. And we all know that when you suffer, it's really only someone else who has suffered who can ultimately minister to you. And that is this solidarity that the Lord Jesus Christ has with our condition. And so you dare to show him with his so terrified that his sandals are falling off because he had to bulge into his mother's arms.
Absolutely. Right? We need to talk about his posture, which is two hands around her thumb.
Yeah.
Foot turned up is interestingly his feet kind of doing a sort of cruciform, and yet the sandals are falling off. And you see that as a kind of vulnerable humanity representation.
Absolutely. That he, that all the way to the soles of his feet, he really took on our condition. He wasn't half cyborg, right? And also that references the future wound that's going to happen to those tender feet. It also represents the Genesis 3:16 proto promise, right, of the gospel to come.
Bruising the heel.
Exactly.
It's so worth pointing that even in the vulnerability and losing one's shoe, it can also be interpreted as a removal of the shoe in order to strike the serpent.
Yes, exactly. All of these resonances of meaning are welcomed. And part of the fun of medieval art is not just to see what has been said, but to do what you just did, to bring in your own interpretation. The canon is not closed in interpretations of these great historical Christian images.
Yeah,
they're waiting for you to come along and provide your own valences of meaning within the matrix of Christian theology, right? Not just out of nowhere, but from your own suffering and experience, and then within the contours of Trinitarian wisdom. All of that is welcome.
Well, we've done eyes, we've done feet. Let's talk about hands and the elongated fingers, the grasping, almost adult scale hands of Christ.
Yeah.
And let's also say the adult scale of his body almost.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is a sort of miniaturized adult form.
Exactly.
Where you'd normally expect a much larger head on an infant, or at least the ratio of head to body is much bigger. You know, babies have huge heads and stuff. But like, this is interesting. So like, let's start with his hands.
Yeah, the Renaissance will gleefully cast off all of these restraints that were arrived at over so many centuries of visual calculations that have an image of Jesus that communicates that he's both God and human, which is why he doesn't look like a little Italian bambino, right? And it's important to emphasize his babyishness, and that's what the Renaissance will focus on. But the Byzantine tradition is so intent on getting this balance between humanity and divinity because they fought for so long for even the right to depict Jesus at all. And in the central chapters of the book, I really unpack the theological debates that brought forth this image, that draw upon controversies like soteriology and predestination and all of these different developments, which are exciting. But I'm glad you're focusing on the visual dimensions, because by depicting him in this way, it both evokes compassion and resonance and compassion also and reverence, I should say, for his divine stature as you look at his features.
Yeah.
But at the same time, both the way that he's not gripping his mother's thumb to cut off its circulation, nor is she clinging to her son because she won't let him go. In some senses, they testify.
She has an open hand. Yeah.
Right. That's how we should hold all the gifts that God has given us, right? Teach us to care and not to care, says T.S. Eliot, encapsulating centuries of English mysticism. But all of it's encapsulated also in the way that they hold. And so, again, what blessing in your life? You can't drop it in this total resignation and move off to a monastery and not being involved anymore, nor should you desperately cling. And so, really, the great German word used by Meister Eckhart and then carried into Johannes Tauler and the Theologica Germanica, and then all the way through Jakob Burma and the Protestant tradition, that great word is Gelassenheit, right? Hmm. Letting go-ness is the best maybe translation for it. And that word, in some senses, articulates the true ecumenical genius of Christian mysticism, letting go-ness, but not completely letting go. Right?
Right.
Because you're still in this mortal coil. One day, God willing, right? Well, not God. We know God wills us all to one day die. And so one day they will be completely letting go. But right now, we're both to let go and to hold. at the same time. And all of that's communicated in the gestures of the hands that you just so well described.
And you also talk about the juxtaposition of fear and confidence.
Yeah.
And I think complexity, right? That humanity is complexity in an important sense. And insofar as this icon depicts the raw humanity of Jesus and identifies with the raw human condition, that simultaneous fear and confidence, which is on display throughout the Passion Week in the Gospels, take this cup from me, nevertheless, thy will be done, holding on to his mother, but not in such a way that depicts any kind of real anxiety. You might say he's a well-attached, you know, he's got secure attachment.
He's receiving this new information and he has to process it.
Processing it. And there is fear. And you talk about versions of the icon that depict more or less panic.
Yeah.
Or
they dial it up, dial it down, dial it up, dial it, and they find the middle.
Yeah. And then, but it's always this like communicating so much at once. And that's the sense in which there's a deep ocean underneath it all, but there is an important kind of gulp of information that is all impressed upon us at once.
Exactly.
I want to park here for a minute to allow you, as an art historian, as an art critic, to be able to speak about the role of the aesthetic. I think there's an opportunity in finding a path of forgiveness and art that unifies, a focus on making Christianity beautiful, that represents some hope.
And that's my hope, is that if you were just to conduct an experiment, we have, and not all of us do, and if you don't have these preconceptions, thank goodness, right? You get to start from scratch. But we're those of us who have been taught the history of Christianity have been taught about these fragments and break-offs, and you know, they're not real Christians, and these are the real ones, and join the right side so that you get all your ducks in a row. And we learn about this fractured and divided Christianity, and that those lessons are not fictitious. But if we just pause and say, what if instead I just look for manifestations of this particular icon and let that be my story of Christianity? This is what would happen. You would not begin the story, right? Now, of course, the story begins with the early church and the Bible. We'll start with that. But when you want to tell the long story of Christianity, you would not begin with the conversion of Constantine or these unifying moments of political power and Christian faith, but instead you would wait for them to expire and then see where the church flourishes outside of those political boundaries. And it is possible today, thanks to these new research tools that we have, fueled by the internet, to create an entire history, a phenomenology of Christian culture, based upon looking for evidence of this icon alone. And all of a sudden, you have this completely concealed hitherto, now from view, fellowship of suffering love, of powerless compassion, of mournful silence, that is a hidden chapter in the history of Christianity that is tethered to this renewal movement of Christian yoga known as hesychasm. That's the deep wellspring of this icon that is stitching a supposedly fragmented global church together.
Yeah.
So instead of throwing up your arms and saying, well, we've gotten it wrong. The Christianity is hopelessly fragmented and it's completely centered in the West when it was intended to be a global thing. No, you just push that aside and say, actually, the visual art has gotten it right and is a evidence that the Holy Spirit has been moving all along to give us something more than the politically registrable form of Christianity that gets most historians' attention.
You choose to end the book in a really interesting way, and that's with reference to Meseret Defar.
Yeah.
At the 2012 Olympics. Would you mind telling that story and presenting how it kind of helps you sum up what you were hoping to do in this book?
Well, it was so annoying because I remember reading an article that said Our Lady of Perpetual Help in Catholic devotional circles just perpetuates female submission and passivity. And so then in the 2012 Olympics, Meseret Defar wins the gold for the 5,000 meter race. And she starts fiddling with her jersey. And underneath her jersey, she had pinned a cloth icon of Our Lady of Perpetual Help. And I cannot imagine the physical punishment that she went through to become the fastest woman in the world. But it's painful to put yourself in. Mm. And so you have surely the culmination of all of this ascesis, all of this physical training, and all of the joy that came from her moment to represent what brought her to this victory to the world. And weeping, she holds up the icon. She pastes it on her face, covered with sweat. It holds there for a while, and then she holds it back up to the world. And she says, "This is why I'm here." She communicates the theology of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church and all the suffering that it has underwent and what the Ethiopian people have and are undergoing, all in that icon. And so if we started this interview by saying, you want to show to a pagan world your faith, show them the icon. That's what Meseret Defar did. And you're going to tell her that, oh yeah, the icon just subordinates women and encourages passivity. She just won the 5,000 meter gold, for goodness sakes. I think she's doing just fine. And that's when I just completed my dissertation and saw that icon. And more people saw the image at that moment, because that was up until history the most well-televised event. More people saw the image at that moment than were in all of Europe when the image was first painted in 1192.
She finishes this race, the victor, in that moment.
Yeah. And it's not just about loss and suffering. It can be, it's about the victory of the resurrection as well.
Yeah. But you see the kind of, I mean, in the image that you chose to represent in your book, it's that kind of weariness of victory. You know, it was a hard fought victory. It was arduous. It was, there was a form of suffering. Like, as you talk about the process of training to do that, that moment is representative of ups and downs and falling and failing and, and yet crossing the finish line in first place. There's still that posture of compassionate suffering and humility and raw humanity and
not gloating. Right.
And also
not boasting.
The fear and confidence again of Christ as kind of like embodied in like someone who embarked on this difficult journey, the athlete, you know, Defar winning that race, doing so confidently, but there is a form of agony in it, and it's just representative of, I mean, this is, you know, that athletic metaphor of the Christian way that is so biblically present and I think accurate here.
Beautifully put.
Matt, Merry Christmas to you.
And to you, sir.
But of course, we have to wait for that. There's a kind of agony in the waiting, and yet a glorious waiting in Advent. And I really appreciate you coming back on. Really have lots of high hopes for this book. And thank you for your work and bringing this to bear in contemporary life.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured art historian Matthew Milliner, production assistance by Macy Bridge. Special thanks to Pamela King. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edit and produce the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. New episodes drop every Saturday, sometimes midweek. If you're new to the show, welcome, friend. Hit subscribe in your favorite podcast listening app, and we'd love your feedback. Ratings and reviews in Apple Podcasts are particularly helpful, but we're just as happy to hear from you by email at faith@yale.edu. We read each comment and do our best to respond and improve the show, bringing you the people and topics that you want to hear. And if you're a regular listener, it's a huge honor that you stick with us from week to week. So I'll ask you to step up and join us. Help us share the show. Behind those three dots in your podcast app, there's an option to share this episode by text or email or social media. If you took a brief moment to send your favorite episode to a friend or share with the world, not only would you be supporting the show, you'd be sparking up a great conversation around stuff that matters with people that matter. Thanks for listening today, friends. We'll be back with more this coming week.